Okay, let's see. Come on. I only let monks I trust do this, because if I don't trust... Okay, it's good enough. Very good. So, one of the things which you will notice in these teachings which I've been given, giving, is usually try and inject somewhere or other a bit of laughter and smiling on the talks. And there's an important reason for that. Even when I was a student over in Cambridge, stupid things which you get up to over there. And one of the stupid things at that time, because I didn't know much better, that, you know, whenever there was any free drinks around, I'd always go. And that was a way that some of the clubs in that university would get their members. The boat club, you know, where you go rowing, were offering just free sherry. So off I went, and before I knew it, I'd signed up. And that was really hard work, you know, rowing in a big boat, an eight. And I was not competitive, that's why the coach would always shout at me, pull those oars harder. But there was one reason I mentioned that story. Later on, as a student, I totally gave up alcohol because I couldn't see the purpose in it after a while. And my five precepts became just natural, not because I was told to, because I saw the purpose in them. I still remember that time when I went to one of the temples in London. And they said, you've been coming here long enough, it's about time you took the precepts. I said, what are the precepts? No one had told me before. You're not killing, stealing, committing adultery, lying, taking alcohol or drugs. And, you know, with the conceit of a young man, I said, Venerable, I don't need to take those precepts because I've been keeping them for a couple of years now. And it was because it was natural. I could see the reason for them. So anyway, but at this time, I was still sort of stupid. But at least I learned something from that when you were rowing the boat. Because as we were in a competition and it was just really hard and the coach was shouting at me, one thing he said, I always remembered, was he said, you are making an ugly face. Smile. And I always remember that was probably worth all that sort of training, for only for 1 year, and rowing boats along the river. And what I learned was that when you smiled, the oar was easier to pull, it didn't hurt so much, and you had more energy. And it was weird, but I thought, well, I'm very happy that you could actually have more energy to pull the oar. And of course, later on, you learned just the smile, the happiness, the attitude you have towards what you have to experience is often crucial. And I recall that when I was over in, I think in Canada, just telling people that one of the first things which I learned as a monk in Northeast Thailand was when the senior monks would all sit in the front of this cab, and when we're going from monastery to monastery, like a ute, a pickup truck, and the junior monks would sit in the back, you know, in the tray. And on the tray, they had some little benches you could sit on, but the back of the tray, of the ute, or the pickup truck, had a metal frame over which was stretched a piece of canvas to try and protect you from any rainstorms. Now, the problem with the metal frame was it wasn't that high, and the roads weren't that good. In fact, there was no roads which were sealed there. There were always dirt roads. So when the truck went over a pothole, the truck went down and I went up. And you cracked your head on these metal railings on the frame. Now, at least for you, you have what we call padding, otherwise known as hair. For a monk, it was just bare skin and bone on these metal railings, and it really hurt. So every time he went down, bang! And of course, I was only a newly ordained monk. So what did you do? Ow! Or can't they drive slower? And then, you know, started swearing or whatever else you did. And I always say that's one of the things about living in a land where they don't understand your language. Because you can always say words which you'll never say when people can understand them. But anyway, what I noticed was the Thai monks, they never said ow or swore or complained. Every time they hit their head, they laughed. And I knew how much it hurt. You go, whack, ah, and they were laughing, ah. Not at me, but you know, when they hit their head. And that was very strange. And so nothing else to do. I started to contemplate, you know, the differences in our cultures. And I thought, how can somebody laugh when they've hit their head so hard? And my first theory was that those Thai monks, because they were older than I was, they must have hit their head so many times more than me that they were already brain damaged. I actually thought that, but I knew these monks, you could talk to them, they weren't brain damaged. So, how can you laugh when it hurts so much? So the next thing to do, you know, being scientists, let's do experiments. An experiment was, I made a determination that no matter how much it hurts, the next time I hit my head, I'm going to laugh. And I didn't have to wait long. And I smacked my head on these railings and stopped myself from swearing or complaining and started laughing. And I discovered a very profound insight that when you laugh, when you hit your head, it hurts less. That's a very deep insight. If you get nothing else from this retreat, learn how to laugh at that. And if you don't believe me, and many of you got your friends or your partners here, just when you go back to your cottage, just ask your wife, can you please hit me head on the head, darling? Really hard. Twice. The first time you swear, the second time you laugh, and then just see what the difference is. If you get to the second time before he hits you back. But that was an important part of the psychology of even meditation. When you're meditating, sometimes I open my eyes early, look at you. How many of you are smiling? Oh, if it's really hurting, it's really difficult, and you know, you have to sort of bear with things, you're restless, you can't get your mind quiet, or you, whatever it is, smile. I'm thinking about all sorts of stupid things, and you smile. My mind can't watch the breath for its life, and you smile. Then you find you can do it. It's much easier when you put a smile on your face, which is one of the reasons why every morning I do my exercises. Do you do exercises when you first get up in the morning? My exercises are 10 push-ups. Do you believe I can do 10 push-ups? Oh, I'm ashamed of you, doubting my physical prowess. My 10 push-ups. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Much lower than that. Because that's part of my job. I have to smile a lot when people take a photo of me. And sometimes, those of you in Indonesia, see me in places like Jakarta, you have to sign books and have your photograph taken for about a couple of hours. Remember the last trip I was up there? Was last February, March or something? But it's a couple of hours. Sign book, smile. That takes training. And so it's the smiley part was how you train. So, but that's not such a jokey suggestion, because when you smile when you're meditating, it's so easy for the mind to engage in this moment. Being kind to the moment. Smile on it. And if you could smile on this moment, it's much easier to be here, just like it's much easier to pull the oar. You've got much more energy, much more engagement. And you find a lot of the skills of life. It's not what you have to do in life, not what life gives you. You have to perform this task or that task. It's like how you do it, how your mind engages with the task. So you make something joyful out of it. And that way, whatever it is, and you can do that, because I do that, and you find whatever you do, you find it is much easier when you just do it with joy, see something good in it, something pleasant in it, something valuable in it, and then you find you just enjoy, and you do it well. Somebody, you know, the previous caretakers here, I think Dani, she sent me this little article once, and it was about some very smart psychologist over in, I think Canada this was, and she was wondering why it was that some CEOs of big companies get sort of cardiac problems, and their cardiac health is not good, while others who do the same amount of work have good cardiac health. Is it because of some genes which create those problems, or is it something else? And the reason why I cite this study was because it's nothing to do with the differences in their genes, nothing to do with, you know, their amount of work and responsibility, but everything to do with their attitude. Whether they took that as a challenge, as fun, and if they failed, that wasn't the end of the world. You know, they could learn from any failures, but they never took it personally, and they took it as a challenge, and they had lots of fun and joy doing these difficult jobs. And certainly, I think the monks here should sort of say that's what I do. Sometimes I do stupid things. You know, just the amount of work sometimes I do. And they're just coming straight back from San Francisco. Straight back and straight to the Shire offices, and then talking to the monks and giving a Friday night talk, and then coming here and just giving this retreat all by myself. I mean, that'd be never allowed by health and safety. That happened to me once when I gave a keynote talk at this conference in London on human resources. And just after the conference was finished, I came back to Perth, and as soon as I came back, I got an email from the British National Health Service. And they said that one of their people were at my talk, they liked it very much, can I come to Birmingham in about a week's time to give a speech at the National Health Service annual conference for the British National Health Service. And I'd only just arrived back in Perth. And so I wrote this letter back and said, I'm surprised at you, British National Health Service. I've just come back on a long flight from England. I've only been back a few days and you want me to come back again. You should know that's bad for your health. And you call yourself the National Health Service. So I politely declined. So when I politely decline these things, I have a lot of fun as well. So no one actually says, oh, okay, never mind. I think they probably read that out at the conference. But when you have that joy and fun with whatever you have to do in life, number one, you have more energy. Number two, you do a much better job, you engage people. And number three, that you never get bad cardiac health. You cannot have a heart attack and a laugh attack at the same time. That's my theory. So, when we put that joy, especially into meditation, to make it fun, then it's much easier to do. And a good example of that is when I was passing through Singapore about Waisak time. That's the celebrating the birth enlightenment, final passing away of the Buddha. We just had that ceremony last May, and I should actually warn people, because at that, the last Waisak which I did, I came to a very scary realization. Because those of you who know the history of Buddhism know the Buddha became enlightened under a Bodhi tree. 45 years later, he passed away. And I looked that this year, I've now been a monk 45 years. Maybe it's my time. And also, I say this a lot, that the Buddha, when he was enlightened, you know, he made a resolution, he will not pass away until he has established thriving communities of lay women disciples, lay men disciples, monks and bhikkhunis. When he'd established a fourfold assembly, then he could pass away. And then I look at myself, I've established the bhikkhuni monasteries and the bhikkhu monasteries and lay centers. So maybe it's my time to pass. No, I won't do that on you. But anyway, where was I going with this? I forget now. Laughter and happiness. Oh yeah, when you do your meditation. When I was teaching this Waisak ceremony, it was some people asked, can you go and teach this little kindergarten? And you know, sometimes I think I'm more courageous. Is it courageous or is it sort of heedless? I'm not sure which one it is. Oh, okay, I can go. And I didn't realize these were little kids, 4 or 5 years of age. And how can I teach kids for about 2 or 3 hours? Got to entertain them or do something. And, you know, I can entertain you with silly stories and jokes, but somehow or other the kids just don't get it. And you can't teach them the Four Noble Truths and dependent origination and all the deep stuff about Buddhism, so what am I going to do? So, you know, just when you are sort of courageous, you go in there and just see what happens. You get some great insights and understanding. So what I did with these kids, so it's Waisak. So what are the three main events of Waisak? First of all, the birth. Or is it? Now, it's apparently, according to the story, it may be a myth, who knows, but actually I'll go on to that in a moment. But he, as soon as he came out of his mother's womb, he took 7 steps and put up his finger and said, I am the chief, this is my last birth. And so I got all the children to do that. Okay, imagine you're the Buddha, just born. And you take 7 steps slowly. And then I might, you're a Buddha, you're not sort of some kid or, you know, some sort of soccer hero or something. Slowly, 7 steps. I took 7 steps and I put up 1 finger, not that finger, kid, this finger. And say, I am the chief, I am the best, this is my last birth. And they all did that. And because it was acting out the part, you know, obviously that's teaching, that's where you learn, when you actually act it out. And I thought, well, actually, that went better than expected. But as far as actually talking when the Buddha was born, now, sometimes people think that these stories I say are just made up, but they're not. Because this couple, the Australian couple from Perth, they came to see me some years ago, actually quite a few years ago now. They weren't Buddhist or Christians, they were just an ordinary couple. They just had their second kid. Now, 2 boys, you know, it's Peter, Paul or whatever. And the second kid had just come back from the hospital with the mum. And so I was in the little cot or something, you know, in their room, while they were just watching the TV or just doing something. And then their eldest son, you know, Peter, the parents said, "Oh, Peter, say goodnight to your baby brother, Paul." And so the little kid, just maybe 3 years of age or something, just went to the side of the cot, leant over, said, "Good night, Paul." And that's when Paul said, "Good night, Peter." And, of course, that couldn't happen. It couldn't be true. So the mum and dad just stopped what they were doing and stared in disbelief. And without any prompting, their kid, Peter, said again to his baby brother, "Good night, Paul." And this time they were paying full attention. And their little, maybe week-old kid said to his elder brother, "Good night, Peter," a second time, clear. And so they were so concerned. You know, where do they go? The Buddhist monks. If they go to a psychiatrist, they'd be, you know, put inside and do all tests on the parents, not the kids. They go and tell their doctor, and they'd be given some drug because they're obviously losing it. So at least Buddhist monks, you know, we've sort of got a bit more credibility and just, you know, previous lives, previous births and stuff. So they came and told us, and it was real. And of course, once you get a story like that, I like actually asking others, have any of you had those experiences? And they're very rare, but other people have. There was this Malaysian couple here in Perth. Once I told that story, they came up and they said, "Thank you for telling that story, because the same thing happened to us with one of our kids. It's just newly born and it spoke. We haven't told anyone about that because we never thought anyone would believe us. But it happened, it was true." And interestingly, it spoke in like an adult voice, as if it was a mature voice. And then afterwards it shut up, you know, for a couple of years until it started talking like an ordinary baby. But the best one, and this, you know, is, somebody sent me this, an article in a newspaper, a good newspaper, so it wasn't some rubbish, sensationalist newspaper, apparently occurred in a hospital in the United States, in a maternity ward, with the gynecologists and the midwives all standing around, and they heard it. They confirmed that this baby just came straight out of the womb and spoke. But the most fascinating, the reason why I love this story, was the words the baby spoke. The first words when it came out of his mother's womb, it was a him. He looked around, still attached to the umbilical cord, looked around and said, "Oh no, not again." Imagine, you know, having to get a bottle in your mouth every time you want to say something, or just a pacifier, and you don't, you know, and say you've got to eat this, and you've got to go to school again. Do you think you're finished with school? Back again. Oh no, not again. So those stories are just very interesting, but I don't know why I got into that. But oh yeah, when the kids doing their meditation, they pretended to be a Buddha. And then the next one was enlightenment. So I asked them to sit down as comfortable as you can, you know, cross your legs, put your right hand on your left hand, thumb slightly touching, just as you see, well, that's actually another image of the Buddha, just like you see the meditating Buddha. Back straight, head down, imagine you're the Buddha. Ask these little kids, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, imagine you've seen so many statues in your life, now imagine that's you, a Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, at peace, totally free, bathed in love and freedom, nothing more to be done, at peace. And you can feel the soft winds flowing across the valley over the Narangula River, through the grove of Bodhi trees and other trees in Bodh Gaya. So peaceful, so calm. And I was just describing the scene. And these kids are usually so restless, who can't sit still for a moment, which has had their eyes closed, imagining they were the Buddha for about 8 or 9 minutes. And it was amazing. And I thought I should stop after 5 minutes, but the teacher said, no. Because I'd never seen the place so quiet. So I was just using that imagination, the feeling of what it must be like to be peaceful and calm. It's like acting out the role. And it becomes this another way of like meditating. They even actually call it Buddha Anusati, reflection of the Buddha. But sometimes people say, oh, it's the Itipiso, the Buddha is this and that and something else, but actually feeling it, getting into the role. And it reminded me, when I was a little kid in primary school or grade school, whichever you want to call it, I do remember the teacher saying, okay, all stand up, put your hands out and imagine you're a tree in the wind. And I remember that. All the children were like trees swaying in the wind. You actually got into the feeling and the emotion of it. And you see that sometimes these actors, I was always interested in that little book, like Awakenings by Oliver Sacks, because he started getting into some really interesting parts of the human mind. People who had been in a coma for about 20, 30 years, and he gave them this drug, and they came out of the coma. 20 or 30 years, and they'd just been totally just out of it, but then they were just awake again. And it was such an amazing little book. And they made a film about it. Obviously, I never saw the film, but I saw the review. And I think Robert De Niro was playing one of the lead roles. And Oliver Sacks, the psychiatrist, he was actually the consultant. And he said he got really scared that Robert De Niro, without being told exactly just what this disease does to you, he was so into that character, he started to exhibit the symptoms, you know, of someone who was got this disease. And he said just one of the symptoms was that your feet started pointing inwards unnaturally. And when he saw this actor starting to do that, he never told him this is what happens. He was getting so much into the role, he was actually becoming one of the patients which Oliver Sacks had treated. And of course, he was so scared, he said, stop it. You know, you're getting too much into character and it's dangerous. But anyway, I always was interested in that and thought, well, why can't we do that to our advantage? Imagine we were Buddha, enlightened, at peace. And when you can do that, it's amazing how much it works. And you feel you're just so peaceful and so happy. And for the last part of that Waisak for the kids, you know, the last thing which happened on the Waisak day was the Buddha passed away. And they'd seen these pictures of the lying Buddha, you know, the reclining Buddha on the side, you know, just with just your hand, your right hand under your right temple, and just even right leg on the left leg. And I said, okay, kids, you've seen that, there's a statue over there. Now, you all lie down and just imagine you are the Buddha about to pass away. So you lie down and close your eyes and you're nothing more to be done, totally at peace. And that lasted even longer. And the kids, the teachers were so happy with me. Yeah, please come back again. Because not only did they get some sort of experience of what Waisak is, but they were just peaceful, and they actually tasted some of that peace through their imagination. And so, I was thinking of doing a guided meditation today, and so, now you know what that guided meditation is going to be. Not the walking and putting your finger up, no. You do that afterwards. And not even the lying down, but just imagining that you're a Buddha, freshly enlightened. And I've tried that several times. And usually we go in the beginning just to imagine you're enlightened and just what it must feel like. That no problems at all, no pressure, everything is done. There's nothing more is needed. You don't require anything more. You're totally satisfied, totally at peace. Freedom like you've never felt before. You imagine that, and then I'll do that for about 10 or 15 minutes with all the talking, getting you into character. And then afterwards, I will just be quiet and see what happens next. A taste of freedom. Okay, so let's give it a try. So, I know the Buddha never sat on a chair with a teddy bear on his lap, but it doesn't matter. You can. It still works. So, if you'd like to get yourselves comfortable sitting in a chair, cushion, whatever, remember the Buddha spent a lot of time trying to get just a nice, comfortable place. The tree, the grass, the shade, the peace. So you close your eyes and you relax your body, relax to the back. Like you've taken so many years to come to this space, a place where it's cool, where you have no disturbances, nothing to do, nowhere to go, just being here. And imagine that rumbling sound of the aircon. Imagine that's the river Nirvanjala, passing by the grove of trees, which is now known as Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha became awakened, enlightened. You can hear the birds chirping. You can feel the warm air of India in May. But not as warm as it is these days. And maybe you can feel the breeze. You found a perfect spot. You've been meditating. You're a Buddha. Imagine what it must be like sitting here, knowing there's not even the slightest of worries left in your mind. As for the past, it's led you to this point of perfection. Everything had a meaning. Even difficulties and pains of your childhood all led you to this wonderful realization of completion, fulfillment. I remember some of my teachers, the ones I didn't like at the time, the one which hurt, I learned the most from. You're the Buddha, enlightened. Nothing more to be done. So much peace in this moment. You can be confident. Whatever the future holds, you'll be able to deal with it, to handle that with a smile, with peace. You don't have any seeds of anger left inside. Everything in this world is as it is, at peace. Free. You don't need to strive to meditate. All that has been completed. There's no goals to reach. Just to sit down and enjoy and savor the deepest freedom from wanting you could ever experience. You're free, secure, safe. Whatever people say about you or don't say about you, you're so free and pure inside, like a lotus. Whoever pours perfume on you or urinates on you, the most refined or the most gross, just falls right off you. Because the lotus doesn't keep anything which falls upon it. That's you right now, a Buddha enlightened. You feel your body, kind to it, at peace with it. Imagine it is the body of a Buddha sitting here. Even the Buddha's body got old and ached and got sick. But even though his body was sick, the mind never got sick. It was at peace. It's all right to be sick. The Buddha was just enjoying this moment. He did not have any more work to be done. That was way off into the future. Now, just enjoying the bliss, the freedom from having to fulfill other people's expectations, to please others, to do duties, all those compulsions had gone for now. You're just you, free being here. No task to complete or to start. All projects ended. Just here, now, listening to the sounds of nature. Feeling the heat in your body. Feeling the tingles on your skin. When you have no task to perform or to complete, no test by which you may be judged, totally free, just being here. You ask yourself what it feels like. What's the experience of freedom like for you? And you smile. Smile like a Buddha smiled. And the more you smile, the easier it is to be here. You imagine you're awake. The joy of being awake. Just like a child can see so much beauty in the simple, you can now see so much beauty, so much freedom in simple things. The feelings of the body, in the rhythm of the breath going in and out of your body, unforced, automatic, natural. The Buddha also breathed, just as you're breathing now. But not forcing it. Letting it come, letting it go, according to how it decides it should breathe. You become this passenger, sometimes in awe that however many breaths you've breathed in this life so far, every breath is unique, different, special. There's no breath like this breath you're breathing now. As you teach it with respect. Just like all the people I've taught meditation to, there's no two ever been the same. Just like your breaths. When you treat each breath with respect, the breath opens up to you, reveals her secrets, becomes fascinating that you're its friend. Imagine the Buddha doing this so naturally, just resting his attention on the breath, breathing in. Imagine, play the part, enter the role of a person who's free. It does not need to control. It's got no frustration or ill will. It's opened the door of his heart, actually torn the door panels off their hinges, so it's always open. Just being free. And you savor the experience of this moment. Sometimes I imagine that this moment is like that concert of classical music. I've got too much respect to turn around to my partner and tell her how much I enjoy this. I'm too full by listening, by being. So I listen to this world right now. I don't have time to think about it. I am it. It is me, this moment. I'm now going to be quiet for the next almost 10 minutes. See where this meditation leads you. Sattva Buddha. Free, not fighting anything, making peace with every moment, not arguing with the world, but listening to her, not trying to conquer the world with knowledge, but being at peace, free in these moments, not needing anything. Nothing can improve how you feel right now. Imagine. Visualize, feel peace, not the word peace, but what it's always been pointing to. This place of rest. And no walls separate you and another. Peace. Freedom. How do you feel? When you're ready, you can open your eyes and smile and take as much as you can from those meditations. Bring them back into this world. That is kindergarten Buddhist meditation. Which is brilliant. And of course, after I taught it to the kindy kids, the adults wanted that as well. Very happy to do that for all people. Now, if you found that useful for you, if you, the next time you meditate, if you try to do that yourself, it will be hopeless. Which is one of the reasons why when we have these guided meditations, they're all recorded. So, your iPhones, tablets, whatever, they do have a good purpose to actually be able to download such guided meditations if they worked for you. So that any place, any time, you can not just listen to a Dhamma talk in your car or at night time, you can actually put your earbuds in and listen to the guided meditations. And it's like, you know, you have your favorite nun or monk or teacher sitting right next to you, guiding and teaching you how to do something like that meditation and bring you into peaceful states of mind. You can download many guided meditation apps from the internet, but the reason why these ones stand out is because you don't pay anything for them. They're not cheap, they're not even free. They are priceless. I like that saying much better than being free. And so if it works, wonderful. You can get it, download it, and listen to it. Excellent. So, was that nice? Is that good? Yeah, great. So, I'm sure the management here can go and sort of get you a copy, or someone's got their iPhone here, you can share it around. Not the iPhone, I mean the talk in that, and hopefully that will help your meditation. And of course, it's only just, was it second, third day, I've lost count. There's lots of days left, so don't rush. Remember what I said the first night. If you get enlightened this afternoon, you know, what the heck are you going to do for the rest of the few days? So don't rush, savor the path. And that way you'll have a wonderful time. That is 9 o'clock already, my goodness. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent.